It's the Burt Cohen Show. What kind of dream is it for Americans? What kind of dream is it for those wonderful, amazing people in Egypt who stood up to the terror of a brutal military and stuck with it and kept at it again and again and again to overthrow the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak? Whatever happened to that, that wonderful, hopeful Arab Spring, which was just about a year ago? Well, on the Burt Cohen Show today, our guest, I'm very pleased to have Medea Benjamin. Thank you, Medea, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Burt.
Well, Medea Benjamin is co-founder of Code Pink, which I'm sure you all know about, Women for Peace, and also with Global Exchange, another great group. Code Pink is a women-initiated grassroots peace and social justice movement working to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, stop new wars, and redirect our resources into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life-affirming activities. Seems pretty clear to me. Global Exchange is an international human rights organization dedicated to promoting social, economic, and environmental justice around the world. And in your spare time, Medea, I'm sure that keeps you pretty busy. Well, thank you again for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. And tell us, if you would, about the genesis of how you got involved in Code Pink's examination and involvement in the Egypt issue. How did you get involved in taking a look at where we, the U.S., is with regard to the people of Egypt?
Well, I was terrified, as everybody was, at 9/11. And then also terrified at what the U.S. response would be when I heard it was going to be a shock and awe campaign, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. A group of us got together to see what we could do and formed Code Pink. We went to Iraq before the U.S. invaded. We saw the U.N. inspectors there. We knew that there was an alternative, that inspections guaranteed that even if there were weapons of mass destruction, we wouldn't be using them. And so we became very determined to try to stop the war, organized and organized. But of course, George Bush didn't listen to our voices. And so here we are almost 10 years later with this horrendous result. And then in terms of Egypt,
yes.
We had been involved in looking at U.S. policies in the Middle East. You can't help but get involved around U.S. policy towards Israel and Palestine. It's one of the causes for so much animosity towards the United States in that part of the world. And so after Operation Cast Lead, when Israel invaded Gaza in 2008, we went to Gaza and started taking trips there through Egypt. And in the process, became involved in what was the repressive government of Mubarak. We had our own share of being beaten up by Mubarak's thugs and came into contact with folks who were fighting the Mubarak regime. And that's how we ended up in Tahrir Square during the amazing Egyptian revolution.
Oh, wow. That must have been great fun. And for those who have never participated in an street demonstration of any sort, it's tough to describe, but there's a certain energy level that goes with that it only happens in that case. Something about having inspiration and enthusiasm and a little bit of tension in the air. Heck, you think going to a ball game is fun? You should try something like that. Of course, it's a little bit more dangerous in Tahrir Square, I'm sure. Well, what is the situation in Egypt now? I mean, the point of the Arab Spring in Egypt, as I understand it, was to overthrow a dictatorship and bring government of, by, and for the people, a democracy, and have the people take over and have the government serving then. What happened between then and now? What happened to those hopes?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Bert, because when I was in the square, I had no idea it was going to successfully overthrow Mubarak. I never thought that would happen because it was such an entrenched regime and because people had really been fighting for years. And when the government repression started, I thought, well, that will be the end of it. And yeah. I was amazed to see that the more the government cracked down and the more they sent out these thugs to beat people up in the square, the more people came out. But people were clear. They said, okay, we want to get rid of the Mubarak regime. It starts with Hosni Mubarak himself, but it's the Mubarak regime. So they got rid of Hosni Mubarak, which in itself was something just short of a miracle. But the regime is still in place, and the regime is the military. The military owns so much of the Egyptian economy. It's got its hands in everything, and that has not changed. And the military, although it got a good reputation in the beginning, in the early days of the uprising, it quickly became clear that it was not on the side of real change in Egypt. It just was willing to jettison Mubarak and keep the reins of power.
Very, very interesting. We're talking with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink about the situation in Egypt in the spring of 2012, a little bit different. Has life improved for the average, you know, person in Egypt? What's it like in the cities and in the rural areas, and how is the economy going? Is life better?
Life is worse in the sense that the economy has suffered. Tourists have stopped coming in large numbers. The investors are worried about an unstable situation. And so the everyday life for poor Egyptians has gotten even more tenuous. But that's one of the reasons why U.S. policy right now is so god darn awful, because here we are giving over $1 billion to the military. And if we really want to help Egypt move towards a democracy, what it needs is economic aid. That's what the Egyptians that we're in touch with tell us. Please don't strengthen the Egyptian military. We need to weaken the Egyptian military and strengthen civil institutions and strengthen the economy.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. I guess I may have answered my own question. If something makes good common sense, it'll probably never happen. Why isn't that happening now? What are some of the factors in Egypt and in the U.S. and perhaps in nearby the state of Israel? Why isn't that aid going to where it would bring more actual stability?
Well, let's see why it was that the U.S. was supporting the Mubarak regime. And one reason was that the regime agreed to a peace deal with Israel. And as part of that deal came this massive amount of U.S. taxpayers' money, both to Israel, a larger portion, over $3 billion, and Egypt getting about $1.3 billion. This has been an annual carrot for this peace agreement. But it's a very strange way of talking about peace, because it was used to hold up a brutal dictatorship that repressed its own people. And the U.S. government never looked at Egypt through the lens of the Egyptian people and their needs. It looked at it through the lens of wanting to support the Israeli government. So that's one of the reasons. The other reason is that this now relationship of U.S. support for the Egyptian military builds up a very strong constituency of its own, and that's the weapon manufacturers in this country. Almost all of that money goes to weapons produced in the United States, tanks produced in the United States. The tear gas that was used against the Egyptian people was made in the United States. So this money goes to support the U.S. economy by supporting weapons manufacturers, and they have a very strong lobby. They are some of the most prolific lobbyists that you find in the halls of Congress, and they push for this deal to keep going through. In fact, one of the reasons that was given by U.S. government officials is that there were already contracts that had been signed with U.S. manufacturers, and this would result in the layoff of U.S. workers if we didn't keep giving this money to the Egyptian military to spend on U.S. weapons.
Wow, that
very
is...
convoluted, perverted kind of reasoning, but there you have it.
Ah, that's... I shouldn't be shocked, I suppose. By now I should be, toughened up to such things. But to have that be dictating policy, man, that's a little bit surprising. And you wrote an article, you co-wrote an article that appeared in Huffington Post about this, that the U.S. is choosing stability over democracy. Well, what kind of stability does this focus on military aid really bring? I mean, is it just top-down repression that keeps things, quote-unquote, stable?
Well, that's right. It really should be stability in quotes, because it can go on for quite some time, and, hey, we've seen in Egypt decades of, quote, stability, but then we see what happens when the lid comes off. And the Egyptian people are very angry at what the regime is doing right now, the control that the military has. But the U.S. is concerned that the Muslim Brotherhood that was illegal under Mubarak but now has become legal, it is the only real organized institution, because so many of the other avenues were cut off for people. And they swept the legislature, and they have a very strong possibility of running the government in Egypt right now, which is something that the U.S. is concerned about. And the U.S. wants to, thinks that it's better off keeping the military strong and being able to use the military to crack down on the Egyptian people and whoever it is that the Egyptian people might vote in these democratic elections.
So, might it be the case that, well, the U.S., the Obama government, the Hillary Clinton State Department want stability, they want democracy, but they're concerned that because the only group that's been able to organize clandestinely, I'm sure, over the years has been the Muslim Brotherhood, and they don't want that group in power. So might they be thinking that if they keep the lid on now by having, you know, just the military regime in charge of everything and with a heavy hand, that perhaps will give other groups a chance to organize, and therefore within, you know, a few months or a few years perhaps, then we could trust the Egyptians to govern themselves?
Well, yes and no, Bert, because when it comes to one of the main concerns of the United States, which is having an Egyptian government that is friendly to Israel, that is sort of antithetical to letting the people decide, because even whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or the organizations that were involved in the uprising in Tahrir Square, the youth organizations, the political groups that were organizing clandestinely, all of these groups represent a popular sentiment that was very upset that Mubarak's regime had this cozy relationship with Israel and was repressing other Muslims, i.e. the Palestinian people. They were very upset that the Egyptian government was selling natural gas at a low price to Israel. They were very upset that the Egyptian government had agreed to close the Egyptian border with Gaza, keeping people imprisoned in that little strip of land.
Mm-hmm.
So democracy brings out a sentiment, particularly around the relationship with Israel, that the U.S. government doesn't want to see take hold.
So then,
and the Egyptian military has agreed that they will continue the policies as they were under Mubarak in relationship to Israel.
Wow, one can't help but see, frankly, a once again a heavy hand from the state of Israel. And I do want to differentiate the state of Israel with the biblical people Israel, which is Jews across the world. There's this thing called the state of Israel as well, which is a rather militaristic state that is occupying, as you say, that little strip of land and a bunch of other things, and heavily military, but isn't necessarily all that close to the real Jewish traditions. Okay, I'm sensitive to that, being Jewish, because, you know, I'm part of the...
Yeah, I am too, Bert, so I'm sensitive to that as well, which is one of the reasons that it drives me to work on these issues, because I do have a real feeling of Jewish values being values of treating the neighbor well and welcoming the neighbor and being kind and compassionate. And when I see the Israeli government cracking down on the Palestinians,
right,
or the people in Lebanon or other neighbors in the region, it really does make me feel a responsibility as both a Jew and an American taxpayer to do something about it. And of course that should help lead our conversation to the issue of Iran, where it's very scary to see that the Israeli government is pushing towards something that could be catastrophic for the Iranians, the Israelis, and the entire Middle East, as well as us here at home.
And Palestinians would not be somehow magically protected, from nuclear bombs being tossed around either. You know, the radiation doesn't differentiate.
No, not at all. It's catastrophic for the entire region.
Yeah, well, we all hope that the state of Israel doesn't do anything that incredibly foolish. But you never know. But we're talking about Egypt right now, and you talk about democracy and the people of the United States. The U.S. public back a year ago was absolutely filled with enthusiasm. It was kind of a somehow we were trying to, you know, live through the experience of the Egyptians and fighting for democracy, overthrowing the bad guys and living up to, government of, by, and for the people. It was remarkably exciting. And I wonder how the Obama administration was navigating at the time. Did they encourage the uprising? And following up on that, there is, as I understand it, a legislative requirement in the U.S. Congress that assistance to Egypt, especially of a military nature, be conditioned on meeting certain very specific requirements. So that's sort of a two-part question, and I wonder if you could go with it, Medea.
Well, yes, in terms of the way that the Obama administration dealt with the uprising,
right,
it really kept supporting Mubarak till the very end. The people in the square when I was there were very upset with Obama, saying, why don't you come out and recognize the legitimacy of this uprising and call for Mubarak to leave? And they waited and they waited, and really it was at the end, very end, when it became clear that this uprising was massive and that it was not going away and it was going to be successful, did the U.S. government welcome it. And that was recognized by a lot of people in Egypt, that Obama had come to Cairo early on in his presidency to give this new, fresh face and policy to the Arab world, saying, we embrace your calls for freedom. And then they saw the reality of it when they were putting their lives on the line, how difficult it was to really get the support of the U.S. government. So that's the first part of your question. The second part is that, yes, there are rules that Patrick Leahy, the senator, put into place that says that U.S. Aid should be conditioned on respect for human rights, that our the equipment and other things that we sell overseas with this aid should not be used in ways that violate international law. And that has been the case both in Israel, where the Israelis have definitely violated international law when you look at Operation Cast Lead, and then in the case of Egypt, the way they are cracking down on the activists, putting people into military courts that should not be used, and some of the horrendous examples of torture, beating, and killing of democracy activists. should be a red light to put a hold on that aid and to say that we will not let it go until these changes have been made and there is respect for human rights. But that's not what happened. In fact, it was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton herself who lifted these restrictions by saying that this was an issue of national security. So it's in the U.S. national security interest to give military equipment to a repressive military in Egypt that violates the basic rights of its own people. So again, we get back to that convoluted logic we were talking about, Bert.
Wow. I so that legislative requirement that there, you know, that certain conditions be met is just because Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said, "Nah, we can't really do that," and you know, we need to focus on security. That's just disregarded. Can they disregard it?
The executive has the ability to override that, and that is exactly what she did at the end of last week. So no matter what the Congress does to try to make sure that our tax dollars are not abused or used in the abuse of the citizens of Egypt, was deemed to contrast, to be a contradiction with our national security needs. And that's why the executive was able to override that.
My goodness. Well, if you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace. Great organization. Check them out if you haven't yet. But speaking of Hillary Clinton, you know, her words, it's funny how words can be one thing and action something else, as we've noticed in this administration. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, generally appears to be concerned about U.S. dollars supporting U.S. values. It sounds like this is just not the case in Egypt. Tell us about Hillary Clinton on this. I don't get it.
Well, Hillary Clinton represents a position taken by the Obama administration. I was just at a very interesting conference these last 2 days, Bert, and one of the speakers was the former director of the CIA and the under Bush, Michael Hayden, and he said that he thought under Obama, he was saying it critically, he thought there would be some real changes in foreign policy, and he was very pleased to discover the amazing continuity of policy. So the Obama administration is very good with words, but when you look behind it, there is not only continuity, but in some ways, worse positions. If we get into a discussion of drones, the issue I just wrote a book about, I can give you many examples there. But in this case of giving aid, U.S. money, you would think that at a time when the U.S. taxpayer is squeezed, when our economy is in such dire straits, and we're looking for where to save money, that the Obama administration might say, why are we giving $3 billion a year to a rich country, Israel, and why are we giving $1.3 billion to a military in Egypt that is not responding to the democratic wishes of its people? But no, that's not happening. That money is still flowing just the way it was under the Bush administration.
I can't help but be reminded of that old song by The Who, "Meet the New Boss, Same as the Old Boss." There's got to be some differences here. But I guess, you know, if you talk about stability, and the title of the article was, you know, stability, there's all this rumbling of the people. A government can't stand for very long. Well, I guess maybe it can if it's just run by a few powerful interests with tremendous amount of guns. I guess that's worked for a long time. How is it that the people of Egypt, who so bravely stuck it out day after day after day on the streets, many of them getting shot and arrested, they did it to oust Mubarak. It seemed as if the military appeared to the people on the streets as if they were not the enemy, that they were just, you know, be in a holding pattern to get rid of the hated Mubarak and to transition into a democracy. It seems like that was fully expected. And what did the military promise, and how do they justify themselves to the people of Egypt that they have not kept the promise? And again, why is it that the people stood up so bravely before but aren't doing that now?
Well, many of the people are doing that now. It's just, one, gets less publicity, and two, less people are coming out because they do have the bread and butter needs of keeping their families together. And they also are many of them turning towards the legislative path to see is there some way they can take power in that fashion. But, you know, it's hard to keep up the energy of revolutionary movement.
Yes.
The Egyptian people were quite extraordinary in not only forcing Mubarak to leave, but forcing the military to allow for elections to take place, setting a date for them, which the military didn't want to do. And I want to give a particular shout out to the women of Egypt, because not only were they on the very forefront of the entire revolution with the first calls that were put out to come to Tahrir Square, it was amazing to me to see what we would consider a conservative society, where the women refused to go home and slept in the square despite the protests by their husbands or their fathers. They said, no, we're staying here, and if you want to do something about it, you better bring the whole family down. And then the way that women were so humiliated by the thugs, by the military, I mean, these forced virginity tests that seven women were forced to do, women being forced to strip naked in front of the military, absolutely disgusting. But they are fighting back so vociferously. They are forcing the military to stop that practice, which actually was going on for quite a long time, unbeknownst to the public. And they are putting up quite a fight also in terms of trying to get more of a say in the government, because it is extremely disconcerting that so few women are now part of the new institutions that are being set up to write the Constitution and pave the way for a more democratic society.
Interesting. Well, I wonder, you know, in conservative Islamic societies, you know, we in the West have all heard about the repression of women, how they just don't have any rights at all. That's in the more conservative, fundamentalist Islamic societies. I wonder what freedoms women in general have in Egypt. It's definitely my impression, again, as a just typical Westerner who has an interest in it, is that Egypt is not traditionally a fundamentalist place, that women can drive cars and vote and things like that. But they have a tremendous amount of power, and it goes for, you know, for centuries, that the power of women should never be underestimated. That they can.
Well, yes, in Egyptian society, the women had many rights, and in fact, if you went to the universities, you would see an overwhelming number of young women. Women are in every single field, very active in all aspects of the economy, but there is a tremendous harassment of women, sexual harassment. Egyptian women would always say that walking down the street, they would be harassed by men, and the public transportation, they would be harassed by men. The police would harass them. And that was one of the things that was so liberating to them when they were inside Tahrir Square. I had women say that they never felt so free in their lives because the men were on their best behavior and they were not getting harassed inside the square. Well, that changed when Mubarak fell and the thugs started entering into the square and infiltrating in the movement, and women started getting not only verbally harassed but physically harassed. There were some terrible incidents, and women got scared of going into the square, and that's why they decided to have a women's demonstrations and take back their rights as women. So they are fighting very hard for rights to be out in public without fear of their physical safety.
And you mentioned elections. What is the state of elections? Am I correct that there were some elections held and there are others still to be held, and that women can run and get elected and serve in the government?
Well, yes, they had the legislative elections, and there are presidential elections coming up, and women are certainly free to run in those. The problem we get back to is that who had the organizing power, and it was the Muslim Brotherhood, even though that they were not a legal organization,
right.
They could organize through the mosque. And so when Mubarak fell, they had an entire network to build up on, and they, within the Muslim Brotherhood, they are not certainly pushing the rights of women, or particularly feminist women. And so the women are having a very difficult time finding their niche in which to organize on the legislative front. And I think there are women that are very upset that they are being pushed out of the new power structures that are being set up. This is an area where the State Department and Hillary Clinton have been speaking out and trying to push for more women's involvement. But unfortunately, so far, we have not seen that happening.
Well, this Muslim Brotherhood, which, as we, you know, pretty much recognize, has been the only organized force, because they could, as you say, organize in the mosques. There are fears in the West of a Muslim Brotherhood government, and I would think there could be a lot of fear in the West and among a lot of people in Egypt who are more liberal, shall we say, of the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is the only organized force right now, so that if there were democracy now, then perhaps would it be reasonable to think that the Muslim Brotherhood could take over and take women back and become more of a fundamentalist and repressive regime in that way? Are there not real legitimate reasons to fear a democracy right now such that the Muslim Brotherhood would be put into power?
Well, I think we have to fear a lack of democracy. And when democracy flourishes, then women get their rights. And when democracy flourishes, people have the spaces in which they can go out on the streets and protest, and in which they can find other ways to get their voices heard. I think this military regime has definitely not been good for women. And women say, if the Muslim Brotherhood starts taking away our rights, you will see us out on the streets fighting for those rights. And I am certain that's going to be happen. I mean, the women that I met in Egypt were so fierce and so determined and so articulate and so skilled at organizing. They're just not going to let that happen. So I would not worry about democracy. I would worry about a military regime that puts democracy activists behind bars and sends them to military tribunals and tries to silence them.
So aside from the Muslim Brotherhood, what other are there political parties that are forming now in Egypt, more, you know, things like we in the West might recognize that might be more, shall we say, liberal again? Maybe even left?
Oh, sure. There's all kinds of parties that are organizing, and there's parties that existed underground before that are organizing, and there's all kinds of political activity going on. There's members of the more liberal establishment that have not only their parties, but their candidates that they're putting forward for president. So it's quite a lively political scene at this point. I think it's just very hard, with the military still in control, for those activities to really flourish to their full extent.
Uh-huh. So if you turn them loose, yeah, it could be...
That's right.
We are talking with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. We're talking about the realities on the ground in Egypt 1 year after the hopeful Arab Spring. And eventually we're going to get to the drone situation as well. But first, you know, I want to continue looking at Egypt. stability in the area. As you mentioned, Code Pink came into existence, if I heard you right, after 9/11, and frankly, the world has changed in a lot of ways since 9/11. I mean, obviously, Bush used it as an excuse to attack Iraq, no relation whatsoever. But the Middle East is very important to Europe and to the United States, to have some stability there. It seems like it's been kind of a simmering powder keg for a long time, every now and then blowing up into real, bloody, horrible wars, such as we saw as the attack on Gaza back 2-3 years ago. But isn't stability, in fact, real important in the area? And that if we, you know, couldn't the administration say, look, if we don't support the military now, then the new government in Egypt will support Hamas, perhaps, and Hezbollah, and that, you know, that would put Israel at risk. And that's got to be a factor in all this.
You know, Bert, I think we just got to get in our heads that we can't police the world, that we can't determine the direction of every other country and their government. I mean, look at us under Bush. A lot of the world didn't like that. And they weren't about to come in and try to re-engineer U.S. society. It took us 8 years, and we still haven't gotten it right because a lot of the same policies under Bush are being carried out under Obama. So we should get our own house in order. You know, people around the world and in Egypt, when they look at what kind of model they would like for their democracy, look at ours and say, I don't think so. I mean, that whole thing of money and politics and the way it corrupts things, and, you know, they get it. They say, that's not what we want. And, in fact, it's very interesting when the Egyptian military took the hostage, the U.S. Advisors who were there with organizations like the International Republican Institute, the IRI, and the NDI, the National Democratic Institute. These are arms of the Democratic and Republican Party that go around the world telling people how their democracy should look like. And while I did not want anybody to be taken hostage in Egypt, I did find it a bit ironic that here were the major institutions of the United States government, and remember, it's a government that gives over $1 billion a year to the Egyptian military,
right,
and the military was accusing them of interfering in their internal affairs, and yet people on the ground that I am friends with said, oh, we think these organizations are ridiculous because we don't want U.S.-style democracy. So, you know, this idea that we can impose on people what kind of democracy, and then if they don't vote for who we want them to vote for, that we find a way to overthrow that government. I mean, look at the case of the Gaza Strip when the people, tired of the corruption and the the Palestinian Authority, turned around and voted for Hamas.
Yes.
And then the U.S. was horrified and said, well, we can't work with this government. So I get back to the issue where we have to let democracy take its course, and that we should just be a lot better at the old-fashioned diplomacy that we don't use anymore, because I find that those who we label our enemies are usually a very varied bunch.
Yes.
And that if we put a lot more of our effort at strengthening the hand of the more moderate elements and reaching out to them, we would be a lot better off than the ways that we are trying to crush the groups we don't like right now.
Well, there's that old saying about the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I wonder about, you know, the role of Israel in all this. Look, I mean, the U.S. has, since 1948, tilted very, very heavily toward the state of Israel. And I think it's pretty obvious that the state of Israel, the right wing, the Likud and other right wing parties there, were nervous about Mubarak being tossed out by the people of Egypt, by his own people. I wonder, you know, how heavy a hand they're playing here. And, you know, they're probably quite comfortable, the right wing in Egypt, with them keeping the military in power. How much influence do they have? Are they a player behind the scenes in all this?
Well, they're a player behind the scenes because they're such a strong player with the U.S.
Right,
and the U.S.
Right.
is really as an intermediary in there is on the side of the Israelis, and so pushes for the Egyptian government to be sympathetic to the Israeli government. Just to give you a little anecdote, there is an Israeli embassy in Cairo, and the Egyptian people were not allowed to protest in front of the Israeli embassy. When we were there as foreigners trying to get into Gaza and couldn't get in, we protested as foreigners at the Israeli embassy. And the local people were so amazed that we were, quote, allowed to do that. Now, yes, the government can't keep the lid on. And this sentiment that is against the Israeli policy towards the Palestinians has not been totally vented. It is there. In fact, this might be a little convoluted story to tell you, Bert, but March 30th is what's called Land Day, and there will be protests all along the borders of Israel, people wanting to march to Jerusalem, and the Egyptian people were going to do some solidarity activities, and I just learned today that the Egyptian government canceled their permits and won't let them carry those activities out. So it's just an anecdotal example of how Israel, through the U.S., manages to have a strong hand in terms of Egyptian foreign policy.
Amazing. Well, as Rocky said to Bullwinkle, that trick never works. Oh, my goodness. Well, Tennessee, I mean, I don't know about Democrats, but Tennessee Senator Rand Paul and Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, not exactly liberals, have both called for freezing the U.S. military aid. They're concerned it's sending $1.5 billion in mainly military aid, quote, would send the wrong message to the Egyptian government that the U.S. taxpayers will subsidize the Egyptian military while it continues to oversee the crackdown on civil society and to commit human rights abuses. Are they right? Are they just using Egypt as an excuse to blast Obama? Why is it that they're doing it and I don't hear from anybody else?
Well, it's such a shame that it takes somebody with the last name of Paul to stand up against U.S. policies that are wrong overseas. And Rand Paul has done an excellent job in that, and as he has done in trying to stop a war with Iran. I might not like a lot of his social policies,
right,
domestic policies, economic issues, but when it comes to foreign policy, give me a Paul any day. And it is really shameful that the Democrats in Congress, who supposedly stand for human rights, have not spoken out against the Egyptian military, have not said, whoa, not one penny to a military that's doing this kind of virginity tests on women. Let's make sure they're not going to keep these thug-like policies. And, you know, they could have even said, we're going to give you the money in installments. They didn't even do that. It's just, we're going to give you the whole thing. And it takes, there are some good people like Senator Patrick Leahy, who is a Democrat.
From Vermont, yes.
He's pretty lonely out there. Yeah. And it is, yes, some of these most conservative Republicans who are standing up for what one would think the Democrats would stand for.
Fascinating. I can't help but see the heavy hand of AIPAC in all this. The power that AIPAC has over the U.S. government is just, it's appalling. It really is appalling. Well, we've been talking about Egypt, and part of the issue about Egypt, I think, relates to an awful lot of places around the world, and that is, you know, it comes back to the old idea of hearts and minds. You're not going to have stability in an area. You're not going to have strong alliances if you don't have some connection, some favorability to the hearts and minds of the vast majority of the people in these countries. We just seem to ignore that again and again and again and keep supporting these repressive regimes. And one of the things that I can't help but think is not exactly winning hearts and minds in places like Pakistan is our increased use of drones. You have written a new book about drones. Tell us about that book. What is the title of it? And how? What is the effect of drones on the much-desired stability for these regions?
Well, it's called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, and it outlines how this policy started, who's producing these drones, who are piloting the drones from thousands of miles away, safe at home in bases here, who are the victims of the drone attacks, and what are the legal issues and the moral issues, and then who is starting to stand up against this. And I also get into the issue of drones here at home, the opening up of our airspace to drones for various activities. So it's a great book. I recommend that your listeners check it out. They can go to the codepink.org website and pre-order a copy. It's coming out in 3 weeks. And I think it's going to be a fascinating look for people at wars they don't even know that are happening. I mean, you might know that we are using drone strikes in Pakistan,
yes,
but most people don't know that we have been increasing recently the drone strikes in Yemen. We are using drones in Somalia. There are reports that drones are being used now in the Philippines. Now, this is all hard to track down because it's a secret program run by the CIA and using private contractors as well. And I mentioned that I had been with Michael Hayden yesterday, former CIA director, and he won't even talk about the drone program. They don't like to even acknowledge that it exists because it's such a secret program. But of course, everybody in the region knows that it exists, and it is creating more enemies faster than it's killing them.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not secret to the people who are on the ground being affected by it. Like the, I'm reminded of the Nixon's secret war in Cambodia. Well, it was no secret to the people of Cambodia, Nixon and Kissinger doing that stuff. And what does, that's fascinating, Yemen and the Philippines. I wonder what that does to American stability, and how can they possibly think that this is an effective tool to use to bring stability? What's, do they really believe that, or is it just, oh, the military contracts mean a lot of jobs?
Well, I think they really do believe that they are taking out key leaders, but they also refuse to recognize that every time they do a drone attack, they are creating more enemies, and so it's an endless list. This is good for the manufacturers of drones that want to keep seeing them made and used, and those who manufacture the Hellfire missiles that are used, but it certainly doesn't do anything to stop wars, and we've had now 10 years of war, and if we continue on with these targeted killings, we will have endless wars. So I think it's incumbent upon the American people to learn more about these issues, to demand that drones be taken away from the hands of the CIA. It's not a military organization. It doesn't have the same, supposed the same kind of controls that the military does, and it has become really like an assassination squad.
Wow. Again, we're talking with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, who's written a book that will be hitting the streets soon on drones. Let's look at one place that Americans are familiar with is Pakistan, the use of drones there. Pakistan has got a lot of nuclear weapons, and, you know, they're not exactly good buddies with India, which also has nuclear weapons. I wonder how drones affect the stability of that region. I mean, lots of innocent people are getting killed. I can't help but think that the people on the ground, you know, the pilots, yeah, okay, it's great for American pilots because they're not risking their lives at all. They're just at some military base thousands of miles away, as you say. But the stability in the region, that's where we're talking about, stability in Egypt, stability in the Middle East, and stability in the East, that Pakistan, Afghanistan, and that area is. What's happening there now? Are the people, you know, acquiescing in this stuff? Is there support for the U.S.? And what are drones doing for U.S. interests, as far as you can tell, Medea?
Well, this is an area in northern Pakistan that is cut off. Journalists are not allowed to go there. It's very hard to get concrete information. And that's why we are doing what's called a drone summit at the end of April.
Yes.
In Washington, D.C., and we've been trying to bring people from Pakistan. Unfortunately, the U.S. government so far is refusing to give them visas. I guess it's they don't want this information to come directly to the American people. But from what we understand, and what I write about in the book, is not only examples of innocent people who are being killed, but it's also the way it's contributing to the instability in that region and in the country as a whole. That the people in northern Pakistan are caught between the harshness of the Taliban and the harshness of the drone strikes. And they are fleeing the area in droves. Amnesty said that about a million people had fled that area, flooding into places like the already huge city of Karachi, creating more tension there. More ethnic conflict there because it's the Pashtuns who are coming in from the north. And so there what seems like very targeted drone strikes killing individuals has tremendous ripple effect. And now one of the most well-liked politicians in Pakistan is a former cricket player, Imran Khan, who has based a lot of his policies and his popularity on his demand for an end to drone strikes, and has been gathering hundreds of thousands of people in the street to call for an end to those strikes. The Pakistani legislature has just been meeting and said demanding an end to drone strikes. And so it really is putting the political situation in a very vicarious one, because the president, Zardari, has also said that drone strikes should stop, but he is pressured by the U.S. government to allow them to keep happening. So I think we're playing a very, very dangerous game. As you said, this is a country that has nuclear weapons. This is a huge country. It's a country that is very poor, has tremendous internal problems. And we are adding fuel to the fire.
Well, as we head out, you know, there's still, I can just imagine people around the world saying, you know, looking at America saying democracy. I think they probably know the meaning of plutocracy even better than most of us do. Government of, by, and for the very rich and powerful. And we have seen for a long time the tremendous power of the Israel lobby in the United States. They seem to be, it's just astounding how much power they have. And it seems like a lot of times the politicians in Washington are afraid to criticize AIPAC and afraid to stand up to the government of Israel and afraid to stand up to the military contractors who are running the show without the voice of we the people, the United States. What can people do to convince members of Congress and U.S. senators, hey, you know, this is not building our stability? What can people do? They can go to the drone summit, which I'm sure you can tell us about, and I bet you have other ideas.
Well, we better stop a war with Iran, because that's what AIPAC has been pushing. In fact, when it had its policy conference, Iran was the number one thing on the issue, and when their members went to the Hill to lobby Congress, it was to tighten the sanctions on Iran and make sure that, quote, all options are on the table, which is the code word for military intervention.
Right.
So we should be contacting our Congress people and saying no war. We should go out to where the candidates are speaking in this election time to be saying no war on Iran. People can sign up to a great petition that we put together. We are handing them directly to Michelle Obama at an event that's happening in San Francisco, and a Code Pink woman who is going to be at that event has agreed to take them directly to her. You can see that petition, which is Say No to War in Iran, on the CodePink.org website. We have been working very hard to hook up with women in Iran and in Israel to come together to say no to yet another war. So there's a lot that must be done to stop that. There are also the conventions coming up this summer. There's a NATO summit that's happening in May. In Chicago, there will be mobilizations going on through the next couple of months that people should get involved in. You know, with the Occupy movement, there's been renewed energy into the anti-war movement as well, and we're trying to merge both of these issues because, Bert, as we talked about today, a lot of the impetus for war does come from the corporations that make their money through selling the weaponry for war.
Boy, is that short-sighted. Doesn't bring stability. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, and if you Google Code Pink, I'm sure you'll find a lot of information. Thank you very much, and every now and then, you know, people can really make a difference. They at least got rid of Mubarak in Egypt, and if we have some courage here, who knows what will happen. Thank you very much for your courage, actually. Thanks for being with us.
Terrific. Thanks for having me on, Bert.
All right, thank you. And we'll hear a little music from Northern Africa, something to get us in the mood and thinking about Egypt. Email me, Bert@BertCohen.com. This is Bombino from Niger.